this morning is the State of Wisconsin versus Ho-Chunk Nation. Mr. Marston.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lester Marston on behalf of the appellant Ho-Chunk Nation. May it please the court. You are asked here today to determine what Congress intended when it enacted 2710B7A2, granting to the district court the jurisdiction to enjoin any cause of action, to enjoin Class 3 gaming that's conducted in violation of a tribal-state compact. The nation interprets that section very narrowly to mean that the district court is only granted the authority to enjoin Class 3 gaming when the games themselves are conducted illegally. Support for our position is found in the plain wording of the statute. Congress was very specific. It said the district court only has jurisdiction to enjoin Class 3 gaming. When can it enjoin that Class 3 gaming? When the Class 3 gaming is conducted in violation of the compact. Congress defined Class 3 gaming in 2703 of the statute. On a game-by-game basis, they were very specific. Class 3 gaming is slot machines, house-banked blackjack, house-banked card games, house-banked table games. In other words, Congress was focusing in on the games. What does the district court have the authority to enjoin? Blackjack. When does the district court have the authority to enjoin blackjack? When blackjack is conducted in violation of the compact. Support for our position is also found in the very relief that Congress provided for in the statute. Congress only provided an equitable remedy. Well, equitable remedies only lie when a party is going to suffer some type of irreparable harm for which they cannot adequately be compensated for in money damages. Where is the state's irreparable harm in this case? This is a case about money damages. The state filed an amended complaint alleging breach of contract, specific performance to obtain a court order to order us to pay money, and are seeking money damages. Support for our position is also found in the very purposes for which Congress enacted the statute. The purpose of the statute was to promote tribal economic self-sufficiency. In other words, so that the tribes would receive the revenue that's generated from the playing of the games, not the state. The other purposes of the statute are to ensure that organized crime is not involved in the conducting of the games and that the games are played fairly. That's the interest that Congress sought to protect with respect to the state. The state's interest in Indian gaming is only an interest in regulating the games, not to receive revenue that's generated from the games.
So what's the forum for resolving the issues outside of the games?
Well, the forum is whatever the parties negotiated in good faith, and that's what Congress provided for in the statute. Congress specifically stated that one of the proper subjects of negotiation are remedies for breach of the compact. And in this case, what the parties did was they negotiated so that the remedy would be arbitration and that the arbitration award would be confirmed in the district court. Unfortunately, the district courts don't have jurisdiction over those types of cause of actions, and the parties now have to go back to the table and negotiate a substitute provision for that provision that they originally agreed to.
Why don't you speak to this duration provision? Because, I mean, I think this case really focuses on that. Give me your response on that, because there's really no case law to support your position. There had been no court that had ruled on that clause, correct?
Well, that's correct. I mean, we negotiated in good faith a term for our compact, and that term was supposed to be in perpetuity. We also negotiated for an effective waiver of the state's immunity from suit. And what the Wisconsin Supreme Court did was they held that the governor did not have the authority to agree to those terms. We put a provision in the compact. At the time that we negotiated our compact, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the Panzer decision, was pending. So we knew that one of the possible outcomes of the case would be that the governor's authority would be struck down. So we specifically negotiated for a provision that would say, if the governor's authority to agree to that term in perpetuity is struck down, then our obligation to make the payment to the state is revoked, and we have no obligation to make that payment to the state. But again, what you need to do is focus on what portion of the tribe's immunity from suit was actually waived by Congress in the statute, because whatever was waived was granted to the district court. We believe Congress, in its capacity as a trustee, would not have eroded away any more the tribe's sovereignty than was absolutely necessary to protect the state's interest. And what's the state's interest in the IGRA? The interest is in the regulation of the games. So that if the nation was operating the slot machines, if they had rigged the slot machines so that they wouldn't pay out, if they had marked the blackjack cards so only the house would win, if they had criminals conducting the games, in those situations, in that limited situations, Congress wanted to allow the state to protect its interest in the regulations of the games and be able to go into federal court and get an injunction. Congress never intended that the district courts would have the jurisdiction to enjoin class regaming for any violation of the compact. And in fact, this court in Ho-Chunk 1 actually said that. You stated that not all violations of a compact give rise to the district court having jurisdiction. And rightfully so, because the parties can put anything they want into a compact. We have a provision in our compact that says that the parties will make certain improvements to the old abandoned Badger military base. We have a provision in our compact that says we'll establish an educational revolving loan fund. Those things have absolutely nothing to do with gaming. They're not proper subjects of negotiation under the statute. They were negotiated outside of the IGRA process, but we put them in the compact. The state would have you believe that if we fail to make an improvement to the Badger military base, which would be a violation of the compact, they can go into the district court and get an injunction in joining our Class 3 gaming, depriving the nation of the essential revenues that it needs to fund essential governmental services for its members, to provide health care for its poor, to provide housing for its elderly.
Well, the state, of course, also wants a cut. Obviously, that's what they've negotiated, and that's the problem, isn't it? Whatever it is, how many millions, 30 million or something?
Well, again, we've paid them already $30 million, even though we had no obligation to do so. We did that as a sign of our good faith towards trying to negotiate substitute provisions. Again, they're bringing this action as a money damage action, and they're trying to use the district court and the equitable powers of the district court to coerce a payment for us. How can they justify that under Section 2710D4? Congress specifically stated that nothing in the section can be interpreted as imposing any tax, fee, or other charge on an Indian tribe to engage in gaming. Why would Congress, on the one hand, state that the state cannot charge us a fee to engage in Class 3 gaming, and then turn right around in the same section and grant to the district court the authority to enjoin our Class 3 gaming if we don't pay a fee? The two sections are in contradiction with each other. Also, we think that the statute is not ambiguous, but if you find that there's any ambiguities in the statute, you're required to look to the legislative history of the statute to try to resolve that ambiguity. Well, the only section in the Senate report which constitutes the legislative history of the IGRA describing the section at issue describes it as granting to the district court, and I quote, jurisdiction to enjoin illegal gaming. If Congress wanted to grant to the district court the authority to enjoin Class 3 gaming for any violation of the compact, they simply would have said so. They would have said the district courts have jurisdiction.
Well, Mr. Marston, on that point, doesn't 2710D7A2, wouldn't that allow another tribe, a third-party tribe, to speak to the limits of the compact? In other words, your view is that the state's seeking the injunction here.
That's correct.
But presumably a third-party tribe could enjoin gaming activity under the language which says any cause of action initiated by the state or Indian tribe to enjoin a Class 3 gaming activity.
Well, we think that what Congress intended in that section is at the time they enacted the IGRA, there were certain tribes that were grandfathered in who had gaming operations that were being operated by individual Indians, that the tribe had license to conduct gaming, and those operations are grandfathered into the statute. So Congress wanted to make sure that the tribal governments themselves had the authority to go in and enjoin the illegal games if those individual Indians who had been licensed to operate the games were conducting them illegally.
And would you say legislative history would support that? Or is that a reasonable interpretation that you're the gloss you're putting on it. I'm not questioning it. But
I think it is. But again, our case is a case where the state has brought the action to enjoin gaming. So you have to determine what is the extent and nature of the waiver that Congress intended. And by defining the nature of the waiver, what was taken away from the tribes is what was granted to the district court. I'm going to close simply by saying that if you find any, we think the statute is specific because Congress used specific language. They focused in on the games. But if you find that there's any ambiguities, you have to resolve those ambiguities applying the canons of statutory construction in our favor. The district court itself found that our interpretation of the statute was plausible. It just said that it thought its interpretation was more plausible. So the district court itself found that the statute was ambiguous and subject to more than one interpretation, yet the district court failed to apply the canons of construction to resolve the ambiguities. That in and of itself is a reversible error. Finally, I would just say that any waiver of sovereign immunity that you find in the statute, you have to find express and explicit language evidencing a clear congressional intent to waive our immunity. Where is the express and explicit language in the statute evidencing a clear congressional intent to waive our immunity from suit, to allow us to be sued for money damages and to enjoin our gaming if we're not paying money damages? The district court erred, and I think you need to reverse the district court, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Marston. Mr. Flynn?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Attorney Matthew Flynn of the firm of Quarles & Brady in Milwaukee, and I have the pleasure of representing the state of Wisconsin. And with me in court today is my colleague Elizabeth Perkins and also the senior counsel for the Department of Administration of the state of Wisconsin, Attorney Michael McClure. Your Honor, I'd like to respond to some of the questions that were posed, but first of all, I'd like to say this. This is a case in which this court is being asked to take interlocutory, in effect pendant appellate jurisdiction on an incomplete record on implicit findings in some cases. And to state it is to raise concerns, I think, in everybody who listens to it. This is the only way that this is before this court is because of the claim that there is sovereign immunity barring these claims. The court will recall back in Ho-Chunk 1, which this court issued in September of 2006, the court held that the initial complaint in this case did not support subject matter jurisdiction in the district court because we'd only asked for the appointment of an arbitrator. And the court specifically said we had not brought a claim to enjoin Class 3 gaming for violation of a compact or in violation of a compact, that we hadn't incorporated by reference the underlying arbitration complaint filed by the nation, which did have causes of action that would support federal jurisdiction. We read that very carefully. And we then got permission from Judge Sabaz to amend our complaint, and in our complaint we have 8 causes of action. The first, second, and fourth causes of action all support federal subject matter jurisdiction. I don't think there's a doubt after Ho-Chunk 1 about that issue. The second one asks for an injunction terminating Class 3 gaming because it's being conducted in violation of the compact. The first cause of action is a declaratory judgment for violation of IGRA. The fourth one incorporates by reference the entire complaint in arbitration of the nation and asks that there be a declaration that we are in good faith. And under the Gould case, the GNB battery case, that does support federal subject matter jurisdiction. What is the response? Well, there was a counterclaim. And the counterclaim that was filed, our complaint was answered and counterclaimed. The first counterclaim is declare that this payment obligation is a tax and prohibited by IGRA. Now, my own view, this case has lingered in litigation for some years, but I do want to read to the court very briefly a letter that the nation wrote to the Bureau of Indian Affairs on May 22, 2003, signed by counsel, who signed that pleading. And on page, this is in our appendix, 231, page 18, it's the Ho-Chunk Appendix, Volume 2. That section of the compact, as modified by the Second Amendment, is not a fee, tax, charge, or other assessment prohibited by 25 U.S.C., in that it is a payment made by the nation to the state in exchange for quantifiable economic benefits over which the state is not required to negotiate under the IGRA. That was submitted to the federal government about 4 years before this pleading was filed, demanding that this be deemed a tax. And what is it that we gave them? We gave them market protection, 65-mile exclusivity, and we also agreed to certain state development projects that we would pay for. Your Honors may recall the Lac du Flambeau case in this courtroom several years ago. In the Lac du Flambeau case, another tribe did come in and tried to object and said, that gives an unfair preference to one tribe over another tribe. And this court and the lower district courts, for a variety of reasons, said that that cause of action could not lie. But in the process, counsel, we gave the link to the oral argument, said to this court, this is the heart of the compact. You cannot abrogate any of this without our presence. So now we're here today with the argument that this is a tax. In my view, there's an estoppel at work here. If there's a representation to the BIA that this is not a tax, it cannot be said now that it is a tax. But more to the point, what is this court's appellate jurisdiction? With all respect to this court, I would argue that this court will come to the conclusion that it does not have appellate jurisdiction. This is an interlocutory appeal. When you appeal in the middle of an incomplete record where there were motions pending, discovery hadn't been completed, and the argument is we have sovereign immunity, fine, we will look at that, but what is the sovereign immunity alleged? Well, the sovereign immunity alleged is that the Congress under IGRA, under 782, meant to limit this to tribes that cheat at blackjack, operate after hours, and so on. The compact is the repository of all of the obligations of the parties. The state had no obligation to give a 65-mile exclusivity and market protection, had no obligation. But in return for that, in the compact, the nation agreed to make certain payments. The case that we cited in our brief that Judge Shabazz cited, and that was first raised by the nation, not by us in this litigation, the New Mexico Apache case in the Tenth Circuit, on a virtually identical facts, said the same. And as we come across other cases that do the same, we'll file them as supplemental authority to the extent they came after the briefing. But what is the sovereign immunity here that permits an interlocutory appeal, much less pendant appellate jurisdiction, on implicit findings? And I would argue very strongly to this court that Congress looked at this and made a decision. Judge Mannion posed the key issue here. Where is the forum for these disputes? The affidavit in the record, in the appendix by the tribe, says they took in $1.9 billion in 2006, $1.7 billion in 2005, and something less than that, but over a billion in 2004. And we're very pleased. But this is a big business now. It really is. This is not the normal Indian regulatory issues that cropped up 30 or 40 years ago. No state in the entire country can agree to go into tribal court. It just simply is not going to happen. And no tribe is going to agree to go into state court because they think they'll be hometown. And so the Congress passed IGRA in the 80s. And why did they pass IGRA? Because they said they recognized that this is a complex set of circumstances with potential benefits for the tribe, for the country, for the states, and for everybody, and there are competing interests. For instance, some states permit legalized gambling, New Jersey, Nevada, and others, and assessing the relationships between these interests is extremely important. The forum that Congress came up with was in IGRA, and I'd like to read the statute. This is not an ambiguous statute, although the legislative history supports our position on it. But if I would ask the court to look at 2710D1C, Class 3 gaming activities shall be lawful on Indian lands only if such activities are conducted in conformance with the tribal state compact. In other words, there's the word lawful right in the statute, not in the legislative history. Then if you go further, 2710D2C, the Class 3 gaming activity on the Indian lands shall be fully subject to the terms and conditions of the tribal contract. Fully subject. And then 27D782, which is the statute at issue here, which the court in Ho-Chunk 1 said we hadn't pled. Now we've pled it, and we mean it. And 2 says any cause of action initiated by a state or Indian tribe to enjoin any cause of action, not blackjack, not after hours, any cause of action. And counsel has focused on gaming. Gaming is occurring, but under what circumstances can't it go forward? And that's located on Indian lands and conducted in violation of any tribal state compact. It doesn't say in violation of IGRA. It doesn't say in violation of blackjack rules. It says in violation of the compact. The compact is a document that has in it, it's the repository of all obligations. And as I say, the Tenth Circuit that looked at it came to that same conclusion.
What about counsel's argument that some of the sort of collateral parts of the agreement dealing with education and all those kinds of things would not constitute, the, you know, if they didn't implement those, it wouldn't constitute a breach of the compact?
Thank you, Judge Williams. Let me just respond to that. And this is probably a very good reason why this court doesn't normally entertain interlocutory appeals and certainly doesn't entertain them to take pendant appellate jurisdiction over implicit findings. Because that particular question, if I were sitting as a district judge, or anybody in this courtroom were sitting as a district judge, and somebody came and said it's done in violation of the compact, that means something. Presumably, it means something that's of the essence of the contract, something material. In normal contract construction, if somebody argues a breach of contract in something that is, and I'm not saying that is peripheral, by the way, that has not been developed in this record. And that has never been asserted, but speaking to it hypothetically, certainly anything having to do with paying $30 million a year, in my view, would be material. And certainly if they came and they said, you were open late one day by a minute, and we decided to go in and try to shut them down for violation of the compact, I think that normal contractual interpretation by a district court on a complete record, not on an interlocutory appeal, and not on implicit findings, would handle that, because there's a fair amount of authority throughout the common law. But it hits the precise issue. Do we want to develop this through common law, or federal common law by argumentation, case by case, or do we want to rely on what Congress did? Because there will be a panel in Cincinnati, there will be a panel in Minneapolis, and there will be a panel in L.A. and New York, and the next claim will be, well, it wasn't education, and it wasn't money, but in this case, they failed to do a criminal check, but it was a misdemeanor that came up, not a felony. And, you know, I think you need a process. You need a process. When the process is there, we trust our district judges who every day look on these kinds of disputes and can make a decision on what's material, what is legitimate, what is de minimis, what is of the essence. And it's an excellent question, but that would be my response, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this. Now that Panzer has been decided, doesn't Panzer render the duration provision void? I understand your position is there had been no ruling and they stopped the payments and we didn't even have a ruling from the court. But isn't that the effect of Panzer?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, and I'll give you my reasons. And on the duration provision, Panzer said what it said on the Pottawatomie, the Forest County Pottawatomie compact. Judge Shabazz himself said, he now thinks that he himself said ours might be voidable, but it hasn't been. And there is this, the whole intent of this negotiation was this poison pill, as he puts it, which means that if we go in to try to void it as a result of Panzer, or anybody tries to go in, we have to pay them back all their money and renegotiate. But, Your Honor, that is not before this court. This is an interlocutory appeal based on
sovereign immunity. I understand, but I thought the Wisconsin Supreme Court was pretty clear in terms of these indefinite agreements in terms of the duration that they weren't valid. So I just wanted a straight answer to that.
Right. In Panzer, that is what it said, Your Honor. There's no question that's what it said. But also, we brought a complaint alleging breach of the asking for an injunction against Class 3 gaming for two breaches of the compact. One is nonpayment and one was failure to arbitrate. Judge Shabazz said, we want arbitration. They started it. We've been here for now the second time. That's what we want. Judge Shabazz has said that we didn't they didn't breach the arbitration clause by just zealous advocacy. In other words, their insistence is that some court define the authority of the arbitrator, the Indian Commerce issue, and everything else before they'll arbitrate. And Judge Shabazz, in effect, has said that is not failure to arbitrate, but it's a catch-22. This court in Ho-Chunk 1 said that we have got to establish federal jurisdiction to get the appointment of an arbitrator where they will have to arbitrate. My view is that an arbitrator in the first instance, Judge Norris, determines his own jurisdiction and his own authority, then that can be reviewed by Your Honors or by a district court. But to ask for, in effect, guidance in an incomplete record from an appellate court as to what the authority of the arbitrator is, I don't think that is warranted. So we have three claims that support federal question jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction. One of them is that they are violating they're operating in gaming in violation of the compact for nonpayment. The other one is for not arbitrating, and that one is not ripe for appeal here because it is an interlocutory appeal. But also, we have a declaratory judgment action asking that we would be declared in good faith, which under Gould, the GNB battery case, you do have jurisdiction over, and that jurisdiction supports pending jurisdiction for Judge Shabazz to appoint an arbitrator. Presumably, he'll appoint Judge Norris, who was their designee in the first place. But, Your Honor, the compact that was negotiated is quite specific. On the sovereign immunity issue in the compact, and I see my time is up.
It is not up, Mr. Flynn.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So a red light
pardon.
Goes on.
Yeah, I thought that was red. It's orange. But in any event, on the sovereign immunity waiver in the compact, Judge Shabazz didn't address that. I mean, that it would be truly an alleged implicit finding that I would strongly urge this court not to review because there's nothing to review on it right now. But that is quite clear on its face that despite Panzer, that is only implicated, the revocation of that waiver, if the tribe tries to collect on a money damage award against us and is thwarted by our assertion of it. We haven't asserted it. We haven't asserted it, and we've cited Wisconsin authority that says that we waived it by not asserting it. And that is not an issue that's properly before this court. But also, the Section 15 issue, the payment of the money issue after Panzer is not properly before this court. That's not a sovereign immunity issue. The sovereign immunity issue is the issue in 782. That's the only issue that's properly before this court. And on its face, the statute says that by our alleging it, that does give subject matter jurisdiction to the court.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Mr. Marston?
Let me start by addressing the fee issue first. And let me give you an example. If we had a provision in the compact that said that we'd pay a fee to the state so that our tribal members could hunt and fish on state-owned lands, that would be in the compact. There's nothing in the IGRA that requires the parties to negotiate over hunting and fishing. That provision would be negotiated totally outside of the IGRA process. So let's look at the fee that we're paying to the state. What are we paying that fee for? We're paying it so the state will not enact any law authorizing other people to engage in the same type of gaming that we're engaging in, to compete with us. Okay? And we also sought indemnification. Where in the IGRA is that authorized? It's not. We're not paying that fee so we can conduct gaming. We're paying that fee so that we have a monopoly on the gaming. And that was negotiated.
That's kind of a difference in kind, not degree, right? I mean,
but it is a difference because we had no obligation, and the state had no obligation under the IGRA to negotiate over that fee. They have no obligation to give us a monopoly. So the IGRA does not impose a duty on the parties to negotiate over a monopoly. So that arose and was negotiated entirely outside of the IGRA process. So the failure to pay that fee is not a violation of the IGRA. It may very well be a breach of contract, but it's not the type of breach of compact that Congress intended would give rise to the district court in joining our Class 3 gaming activities if we failed to pay it.
Otherwise, you're saying the language of 782 precludes that?
That is absolutely correct. If we failed to pay the fee, what they're arguing is, and this is why we say it's an illegal tax, if we fail to pay the fee and that failure becomes a precondition to us engaging in gaming, it's an illegal tax. It's what Congress prohibited. We didn't agree to pay the fee to engage in gaming. We agreed to pay the fee for the state to give up something that they were not obligated under the IGRA to negotiate over or to give up. It was negotiated entirely outside of the IGRA process. And because it was negotiated entirely outside of the IGRA process, Congress could have never had in its mind at the time that it enacted the IGRA that the district court could, in essence, enjoin the tribe's Class 3 gaming as a precondition to force us to pay a fee that Congress never even contemplated we'd be negotiating over.
You're saying it would not have been in the contemplation of the legislators, national legislators, the granting of exclusivity, geographic exclusivity.
That is something that arose years after the passage of the IGRA for the first time, and the Secretary of the Interior had to determine whether a tribe in a state that negotiated that kind of provision was violating the IGRA. And they said, since it arose outside of the IGRA, and the tribe is receiving valuable consideration in exchange for the fee that it's paying, it didn't violate the IGRA. But that's not what the state is saying here. The state is saying, look, if you fail to pay the fee, then you can't engage in gaming. They want to make the payment of the fee a precondition to us being able to engage in gaming. That makes it an illegal tax under 2710D4.
What if the state altered the age for gaming? Would that be outside IGRA?
I think that goes to the regulation of gaming. Who has enough sophistication to be able to play? And they have a state interest in protecting their minors from gambling operations. So that goes to the regulation of gaming. But, you know, be prepared. If you adopt their interpretation that any violation of the IGRA or any violation of the compact gives the district court's jurisdiction, you're going to turn the federal courts into small claims court for every type of small violation. Every time, you know, we serve liquor and there's a liquor violation that has nothing to do with gaming. Every time, you know, some minute provision in the compact is violated, under the state's interpretation, 2710D7A2 gives the district court jurisdiction, and then look what Judge Shabazz did. He pulled in everything else, all of their other causes of action, under his pendant jurisdiction. The breach of contract action, the money damage claims. Congress never intended that. And we would ask that that you reverse the district court's order.
Thank you very much. And thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under